So I'd like to continue this reflection upon compassion and its relationship to pathways of awakening, this Chetavamuti that I mentioned yesterday, the awakening of the heart through the Brahmaviharas, through the qualities of the Brahmaviharas. Now, compassion, as we see in our own experience, it rests upon many things. It rests upon kindness, it rests upon courage, fearlessness, but it most deeply rests upon our understanding of dukkha and our reactions to dukkha. Now, we spent quite a lot of time yesterday with this word dukkha. Is anybody unfamiliar with this word? Dukkha. Okay, essentially the primary translation of dukkha is it's a messy space. That's the primary, most accurate translation of dukkha, is a messy space. The image that's used in the early teachings is if you had a cart, an ox cart, as we all do, of course. If you had an ox cart and you had a kind of square axle going into the round hole of the wheel shaft, that basically as you pulled your ox cart along, or as your ox cart was pulled along, it would go bumpity, 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 bump. It's a bumpy ride. It's a bumpy ride. So yesterday we spoke about the dukkha that is simply woven into human experience in terms of aging, sickness, death, unwelcome change, loss. And we spoke about the dukkha that is often encountered in our experience, which is born of greed, hatred, and delusion. These ask for different responses, very different responses. And I will get into that a little bit later. But then the Buddha says, I teach just one thing, that there is dukkha and that there is an end to dukkha. This is not a particularly consoling message, I think, because it really does ask us to look quite fearlessly at our own hearts and lives as the classroom of this understanding. How does dukkha come to an end? But this is the understanding that truly takes us into the universality of human experience. Compassion is much about expanding the circle of our concern. And we know how challenging that is. I mean, any of you in this room who are currently or have been in the past in the midst of real life challenges, you know what happens in that, how often our tendency is actually to contract the circle of our concern. So it's understandable, but the circle of our concern gets contracted around our illness or the illness of a loved one, you know, all the stories around that. And compassion is asking us not to dismiss that, but to learn how to keep the circle of concern wide and to begin to acknowledge the universality of the human story of distress. The human story of distress. It's like when we stop asking the question, why did this happen to me? And instead are able to say, why would it not happen to me? That's when we're stepping into that more universal story of human life. Now, when he looked at his own life and the world around him, the Buddha saw so clearly that not only is dukkha universal, but that so are many of our reactions to dukkha. Is in the face of pain, we're at times prone to become quite angry. Whose fault is it? You know, if I could find the right person to blame, I would probably feel a little bit better. It must be somebody's fault. We can become aversive. How can I make this go away? And in turn become agitated. One of our classic responses is, how do I fix this? You know? And I think this is where this aspect of compassion of anukampa is actually so critical, this capacity to be still and to listen. Because if we skip over that and move right into the karuna part of what does this need, the near enemy of this is, how do I fix this? You know, and that's a pattern of agitation. At times we become quite despairing in the face of pain, you know. It's all too much, it's overwhelming, there's nothing I can do about it. You know, life is essentially unfair. At times, I think particularly in Western cultural psychology, we've, you know, also developed another area of expertise, which is around shame. You know, I must have done something to deserve this. You know, it probably is my fault, you know, and it's because I'm not good enough or I've done something wrong. It seems to me that our life, that how we respond to dukkha very much defines who we believe ourselves to be as human beings and very much defines how we live our life. If we fear dukkha, or argue with dukkha, it's very likely that we will live a life of avoidance, doing all that we can to manipulate conditions so that the difficult doesn't touch us, or doing all that we can to sort of deny the universal story as having anything to do with us. So if we fear dukkha, avoidance is almost the natural outcome of that. But there's something more to it, because in that patterning of avoidance and aversion, we also form a self-view of incapacity. I'm unable to meet this. I'm not good enough, or I don't have the resources, or it's too much for me. So we tend to form a self-view of incapacity. If we have the capacity to listen and to meet pain, this will also define our life in terms of how we engage with the world, in terms of what we include, in terms of what we're sensitized to, and actually how we see ourselves as a human being, as a participant in a pathway of alleviating dukkha when it can be alleviated. The Buddha really describes the unwise reactions to dukkha, and he says there is another way, that dukkha is to be understood. That dukkha is to be understood rather than compounding dukkha. Now, any of you who've read any of the early teachings of the Buddha will have encountered this phrase that is repeated with a lot of frequency, the encouragement to see things as they actually are. Encouragement to see things as they actually are. And, you know, when you hear that phrase, it can sound a little bit like a sort of statement of ideology, or we might tell ourselves, of course I see things as they actually are. You know, the world is, you know, is imperfect, you know, people are, you know, schmucks, you know, most people are depressed, you know, everybody's greedy. Of course I see things the way they actually are. But what the Buddha's teaching was doing was really an encouragement to change the lens of how we see the world. So when he describes things as the world of, see things as they actually are, this is about seeing through the lens of change and impermanence, really meeting the dukkha that is woven not only into the unpleasant but also the pleasant, really seeing the world of conditionality, you know, how all moments of experience are born of a matrix of conditions, much that we don't control or choose. No one got up this morning and ordered the fog, okay? To see things through the lens of non-self, not only non-self inwardly, that there's nothing that has an independent self-existence, but to see this in all things. This is what the Buddha describes as shunya or shunyata or emptiness. He says, as long as we are not seeing things as they actually are, we are in a state of arguing with the unarguables. this is a state of tension. This is a state of stress. You know, this is a state of agitation. This is a state of aversion, to be constantly in that position of arguing with the unarguables. And you might just reflect, you know, I mean, I know we tell people not to take things personally, but take it a little bit personally, you know. Like, where do you see yourself arguing with the unarguables, you know, at this moment in your life? You know, and what is the outcome of that? And when you read a lot of the early discourses, you see that so much of the Buddha's teaching medium was actually through dialogue, through communication, through conversation. And most of those conversations was actually begin with arguments. And much of the teaching was that as long as we're in this state of argument, we will resort to ill will, we will resort to aversion, we will resort to picking up arms and harming each other. And actually much of the skill of this practice and the art of this practice is learning to put down our arguments with the unarguables. This is not recommending a state of passivity, you know? Is not recommending then a state of just, oh, well, this is the way things are. Ah, no, this is the way things actually are. Then what is asked of us in response, other than aversion, other than agitation, other than anxiety, other than argument, what is actually being asked of us instead of all of that? Now, compassion actually begins with our willingness to put down the argument, because the argument is the way that confusion and delusion manifests, and aversion and craving are our ways of endeavoring to win the argument. Can you see that? This is how we end. You know, it's so interesting when the Buddha, you know, so says that, you know, that, or proposes that craving is the origin of dukkha. And here he's talking about the argument. You know, this moment's just not good enough. It shouldn't be like this. It should be different, you know. The craving is the origin of dukkha, and yet so frequently we use craving to try and quell dukkha in large and small ways. Then I'm discontented, I'll just make it better. You know, I saw a sign in the elevator at my hotel this morning. It said, "Reward your cravings." And clearly, it was an advert for some sort of toffee pie. You know, here was the obvious solution to dukkha. You know, just have a slice of pie. You know, I mean, that feels very crass, doesn't it? You know, but isn't it a kind of the message we inherit, the message we generate? You know, if there's discontent, just get a little craving going, you know, and success in that, and you're going to have a moment relief from that dukkha. So we're not always seeing the ways that we get locked into these closed feedback loops, you know, of discontent, using craving to resolve it, you know, finding the resolution didn't actually work, you know, more craving, you know, or more aversion, getting rid of something. How much we actually place ourselves in a position of really being hostage to the world of conditions. And it's not that we are invulnerable to the world of conditions, but to be hostage to what makes us a hostage to the world of conditions, a prisoner of it, is, of course, the mechanisms of craving and aversion. This is how we create the other. So for our hearts to tremble in the face of dukkha, first, I think we need to be quite honest about those mechanisms of perpetuating and recreating dukkha on every level in our lives, and actually to find the stillness that allows us to put down the argument and to be able to ask the compassion question of what does this need? What does this need? Compassion has another piece of insight within this, because it's not just about understanding dukkha as a path of awakening. Compassion actually rests upon learning to take the I and the you out of an unfolding life process. Because if we can see how, you know, that very centralization of the sense of self with all the views about who I am, you know, the identification with this, the clinging to this, is equally, of course, a creation, as we spoke about yesterday, of the other. It's really understanding the powerful role that self-view plays in creating estrangement and in sustaining the other. Now, compassion is not an easy path. You know, we live in a world where, you know, with all of the conflict, with all of the, you know, the division and the ill will and the alienation and the mistrust, you know, it's, again, not difficult for us to feel compassion for an injured puppy. But when we actually face, you know, tides of rage and people who seem to be perpetrating harm, people who may be hurt, well, be perpetrating harm. This is actually the real grit, isn't it, of compassion. It's the real grit of compassion. In the early years of my teaching in the Tibetan tradition, you know, where there's so much emphasis upon developing anukampa karuna as your primary motivation for your thoughts, words, and acts, you know, I'm quite sure these Tibetan teachers just found us Westerners pretty weird, because we were always arguing with them, and we weren't used to people arguing with them all the time. And one of the big arguments was around, you know, how to respond to injustice. And, you know, my teacher used to look at us with this stony stare, and he would say, "Swallow the blame. Swallow the blame." And, you know, we would immediately be outraged. No, if we swallow the blame, people are going to get away with stuff they shouldn't be getting away with. You know, we're going to be somehow condoning the unacceptable, you know. And he would just look and say, "Swallow the blame, swallow the blame." And then it took me a long time to understand, you know, how blame is actually tying me to the person that I am really objecting to, and actually tying me to them in a similar vein of aversion, was the most critical part. Swallowing the blame didn't actually mean consenting to anything, but actually it did free up the capacity to be more skillful and clear and less I and you in the responses to suffering and the creation of suffering. I know this is a really hard one, I think, for us to really absorb, you know, when there's so much to be offended by. And yet, if we don't swallow the blame, we're either going to retire in exhaustion from our own aversion, or we're going to strike out with the same aversion that is actually creating the distress. And the Buddha says there's no good outcomes from ill will. You know, that's a hard one to actually really absorb, that there's no good outcomes from ill will. And that wise action does not create more victims or enemies, but engages with suffering and its origins and the dedication to bring it to an end. It's where empathy, the heart that can be touched and tremble, engages with karuna. How do we act? How do we speak? How do we engage? How are we dedicated to relieving suffering? And that means we have to also step out of a lot of our conversations, a lot of our narrative about it. Last night when I was going into my hotel, I was stopped by a young man pushing an elderly woman in a wheelchair, and they asked me for some money. And I had a conversation with them. I said, "Are you sleeping out tonight?" And they said, "Yes." And the young man, this was his mother in a wheelchair. And they told me the story about how they ended up in the street, about how she got ill and how she had to quit her job and he quit her job, and so they lost everything. And there's no way out. They don't know of a way out. And you know, it's a moment, isn't it? You can get into a whole narrative about that, you know, about the society and this lack of care and, you know, who's looking after these people, this shouldn't be happening. It is happening. It's an isness. It is happening. All kinds of other things should be happening. But my narrative of aversion and blame and shame is actually not going to help that which needs to be happening to be happening. You know, and there's that real question, that moment, the wisdom question, what is actually going on here? And the compassion question, what does it need? And it needs multiple things, many of them far beyond my capacity, but it's no denial that multiple things are needed. So where do we begin, you know, because it's such a big picture of dukkha, isn't it, in our world. It's such a vast picture. The fabric of compassion is always, as with all the Brahmaviharas, it is related to what is possible in this moment. We cannot do tomorrow's compassion. We cannot do, you know, the world, relieving the suffering of the world, but we act as if it's possible to do so by meeting the dukkha that is right in front of us as skillfully and as kindly, as compassionately as possible. And the alternative is to turn away. And I think, you know, turning away is another way of consenting to the perpetuation of dukkha. That can feel so hard and so challenging. You know, it's so interesting the way that compassion practice, you know, traditionally develops so differently than metta practice. You know, the compassion practice starts really often when we develop it as a practice in the ways that we inherit it, often with the blameless, you know. Life, you know, really difficult things happen to really good people. Begin with just that sense of being able to tremble in the face of that suffering and that pain and that distress, you know. The places where, you know, where we actually know what empathy feels like. We know what empathy, we have a taste of empathy, you know. And then actually it will expand, you know, to, you know, people in our lives, you know, that we love, who are in distress and suffering. And then it actually goes right into those who perpetuate suffering, because the Buddha actually really said, you know, when it comes to avidya, when it comes to ignorance, there's no point in blaming anyone for avidya. You know, and I think we can recognize this in our own lives. You know, none of us gets up in the morning, you know, with the intention to speak harshly or to be reactive or, you know, to be aversive. You know, none of us has that intention. You know, adding blame to that, you know, it makes no sense, you know. There might be blame attached in refusing to acknowledge avidya. This is where there might be some real questions. You know, but when the Buddha talks about avidya, ignorance, you know, he talks about it in two ways. There's actually not knowing the way things actually are, just being confused, not knowing. But the other big part of sustaining ignorance is not wanting to know. And that's actually a bigger piece than not knowing how things actually are. Because in a way, you know, in a sense, it really only takes a little contemplation for us all to actually really tune in to change dukkha and non-self. This is not difficult, you know. This is a very accessible, approachable piece of understanding for us all. But only if we want to know how things actually are. If we don't want to know how things actually are, you know, we put everything in place for the creation and recreation of distress. So the Buddha says, not knowing how things actually are, you know, there is no blame attached to this. This will lead us to act with confusion and delusion and ill will. But we can wake up. we can indeed wake up and put down the argument and align ourselves with those characteristics and live in the light of that understanding. Living in the light of that understanding is what allows for compassion. But not wanting to know how things actually are, I think this calls for some real examination on our parts, how much we do the pretend game. You know, everyone dies, but not me. You know, of course everyone gets ill, but not me. Of course people age, but I've invested in these, you know, these beauty creams. You know, I'm not aging. You know, I'm hanging in here. You know, it's not going to touch me. You know, how many ways we sort of, in small and large ways, engage in, I just don't want to know. And yet wanting to know is the beginning of healing dukkha. Being able to ask what that needs and bring what needs and taking the I and the you out. Shantideva put it very clearly, you know, just as I would reach out to touch a wound in this leg as part of this body that asks for healing, why would I not reach out to touch the wound in another as part of this body that asks for healing? So it's a reorientation, it's a pathway of understanding. Compassion asks for a great deal of insight and alignment and embracing the way things actually are. Embracing the dukkha that asks simply for stillness and care and tenderness, and embracing the dukkha that asks to be uprooted, both inwardly and both outwardly. Pause moment, because I'm, as I said, we're going to gallop along today. Any reflections, any questions about this? Yes, please. Well, I asked them what would be helpful right now.
But if they said no.
They said we could use a hot meal.
Mm-hmm. So you just gave them some money for a hot meal?
Yeah.
So it's like narrowing it down to saying, how can I help you in this moment?
Maybe
the guy said, I need the bath.
Maybe I can't help that. But you know, when you think about the sort of bodhisattva vow, you know, it's kind of making this commitment of recognizing the immensity of suffering and the impossibility of ending it all, but acting as if it's possible to do so. And it, you know, when we hold the big picture, of course there's despair, you know. When we hold the big picture, of course there's a feeling of helplessness and there's just not enough resources in the world to heal all of this. But then when we come down to what is really right in my attention field just now, maybe there is something that makes a difference. It's certainly not curing the immensity of the situation and the dukkha, but maybe does it make a little difference right now? Maybe does it also mean that you care? And that care is something that actually we embody, because you do care. If you didn't care, you wouldn't feel despair. So you do care. You ask yourself what is possible right now. I'm sure we all meet these situations, you know. I'm sure many of you are kind of living with sort of, you know, elderly relatives, you know, where there's so little you can do to actually make life happy. But maybe you can do that one thing, you know. You may live with troubled family situations, you know, troubled communities. Maybe you can offer, you know, you can ask that question, what does this need? And, you know, the list is endless of what this needs. But this actually could be answered just now. Compassion is actually, you know, this quality of empathy is just so too priceless to neglect, you know, because when we neglect empathy, we recede into numbness or shutting off or turning off because of the bigness of the picture and we feel so powerless. But, you know, if we lose that capacity for our hearts to tremble in the face of another person's suffering, we also lose the empathy for our hearts to tremble in the face of our own, the dukkha within. Isn't it? No. Helplessness is a reaction to the trembling. Helplessness is, we've already moved into the reaction, you know. Oh, there's nothing I can do, or there's so little I can do, you know. So, da-da-da-da-da, that narrative is endless. Or you actually really calm that agitation, and just come back to that trembling, the sensing of the pain of that moment, you know. What you do is probably far lower down in the scale in terms of what matters to another person. How you are probably matters far more.
So the minute, you know, that in that moment, that when you're standing there, you feel that shift in yourself, you're going, oh my God, I don't know what to do.
No, that's already, you've already moved.
You've already moved.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, sometimes in many, many situations of distress, there is actually nothing we can do, but there is always something we can offer. And sometimes all that we can offer is actually our wholehearted presence and stillness and for someone to be visible to us. Sometimes that's all that we can offer. I think, you know, this is where, you know, it's so important because this is where the Brahma Viharas, the qualities of the Brahma Viharas never can stand alone. They actually really need each other. And this is what we'll talk about next, you know, because compassion separated from joyfulness and equanimity, that's where it sinks. That's where it sinks. So compassion can never be a standalone quality. If it's not balanced by joyfulness and equanimity, I think the despair stands very close.
I will. I wonder if you have any suggestions.
So the reflection was in working with a lot of indigenous people and teaching people to write. And when people write, a lot of the pain comes to the surface. And sometimes all that can be offered is to go and walk with someone and sort of be a companion. But at the end of the day, totally emotionally spent. And, you know, how to meet that. That's where we're going to go next. Okay? Yeah.
It sounds like part of how I interpret it is that I think building up trembling, and that that's sort of like when you use that analogy of sewing your suit, the superhero suit.
Your parachute.
Right. And that's sort of like a building anything. It's a process to be able to tolerate that. And I was also wondering, maybe you'll get to this, but it seems like your empathy and compassion can be, it sounds like they can be used interchangeably, but I'm wondering if you might talk a little bit about the difference between
Well, as I talked about it yesterday, empathy, anukampa karuna. So anukampa is the empathy, the trembling of the heart. The karuna is what we do, okay? But, you know, if you look, you know, because there is so much attention given to the development of anukampa karuna in the Buddhist teaching, you know, this is actually what relieves suffering. You know, this is what the whole path is concerned with. And if you look at someone like the writings of Shantideva, you know, who was really, you know, one of the great poets of compassion and emptiness, by the way, you know, Shantideva was one of the great teachers who actually so pointed to how, you know, compassion is incapacitated by the view of self and other. You know, that compassion is liberated by liberating the view of self and other. But for example, in the Buddhist tradition, compassion is such a spectrum quality, you know, because it includes fearlessness, it includes courage, it includes resilience, it includes patience, it includes forgiveness, it includes generosity, you know, it includes insight, you know. There are so many aspects to the sort of compassion landscape. And part of it, as you point to, is the ability to bear with discomfort, because that is where the aversion mechanism kicks in. You know, and it's pretty, I think it's, you know, whatever we practice, we get better at. You know? So if we discover that we practice aversion in even the smallest moments of discomfort, you know, I'm getting rid of this, I'm getting going to fix this, get away from this, we're actually undermining our capacity for resilience and our capacity to stay with the difficult, you know, which is why often in meditative pathways, you know, you actually learn to bear with the discomfort. You know, you actually learn to bear with it, you know, whether it's physical discomfort, whether it's thoughts that you don't like, you know, whether it's mental states that you find, you actually are learning to bear with the uncomfortable, you know? So you're actually learning to undo that aversive pattern, that flight pattern. This actually is a huge part of meditative training. As I mentioned yesterday, the biggest shift I ever see people make is from aversion to befriending, from turning away to turning towards, you know? Because this is what begins to break open that pattern of dukkha being met with reactivity. You know, that the biggest, you know, there's two primary functions of sati. The first primary function of sati is to break the link, to sever the link that seems so automatic between feeling tones of experience and underlying patterns of reactivity. So the painful, the unpleasant can be met with curiosity, with befriending, with investigation, rather than with aversion. You know, the pleasant can also be met with curiosity, investigation, rather than craving. It's the first primary function of mindfulness, and it's certainly, you know, the primary function that's used in contemporary mindfulness teaching, you know, in terms of living with chronic pain or illness or depression, you know, learning to sever that link. And the second primary object of mindfulness is to clean up the field of perception, which is actually to clean up the field of views, the ways that perception gets loaded with historical emotional memory, which actually leads to the views of I am, you are. So both of those are actually really, really developed just simply through our willingness to meet what is without the added layers of interpretation and story and reactivity. And this is where we learn to bear with the uncomfortable. It doesn't mean getting into gritting teeth. It also knows when to move away from the uncomfortable if we're being overwhelmed. So it's not about you know, gritting our teeth and bearing it. You know, it's not about that kind of stoicism. It's not about willpower. But it's learning that we have the capacities inwardly not to be overwhelmed and not to be reactive to every slight touch of the unpleasant. Yes, please.
When I confront one of those kinds of situations and I find myself, for example, choosing to let the person be visible, and that seems like sometimes all one can do.
Yeah.
When I feel that way, it's almost always followed by feeling guilty that I'm colluding with the forces that I know are in some ways responsible for that person.
Yeah.
And it seems selfish in a way.
What seems selfish?
To say there's not much other than being present in the moment and...
It's not just all there is. Yeah.
And that's all I can do.
No, it's not all you can do.
It's always disturbing.
So, you know, the question is, okay, you meet a situation where there's, you know, severe distress, such as, you know, we take the homeless situation, you know, that, yes, sometimes all I can do is to be present for another person, but and then feeling guilty because it's been part of a, you know, a culture and a world that somehow has set up systems of injustice, you know? Not somehow, that has consciously set up systems of injustice in order to profit, in order to protect, you know, the privileged, to put cards on the table, you know? I mean, this is what the Buddha was dealing with in his time also, you know, and which is why he was as much a social activist as he was a contemplative. So, you know, there are different layers, aren't there? Different layers of responsiveness to dukkha, because there is, you know, the dukkha that we meet right in the moment, and then there's a layer of the dukkha which is actually collective delusion or collective aversion or collective greed or collective privileging of myself, you know. And, you know, here too, you know, it's very easy to say there's not much I can do about that. There's millions of things we do about that. Yeah, there's millions of things we do about that. And this is where, you know, the Buddha spent most of his life endeavoring to change the society he lived in. You know, and it's certainly not, you know, it's not, oh, I make myself perfect first and then I see what I can do outwardly. The world has not got the patience for that. And it's about how much understanding do I need to actually engage with the world? I mean, it's not going to be perfect understanding, but whatever limited patience and compassion and metta I have, it's enough. You know, because I think also there's this view as I'm going to refine myself inwardly and become such a perfectly patient person, then I'm going to be great at changing the world I live in. The world doesn't have the patience for that. Life needs us far more than that.
I'm not sure if this is the solution, but this is what I do when I'm encountering people in bad situations on the street. I imagine them really healing. Like, really. I don't know if it's the solution, but I remember.
I don't think there are solutions. I don't think we're looking for solutions here, you know. Well, you know, and I think this is a place where we can go too quickly about what is the solution, rather than actually, you know, and this is perhaps one of our coping mechanisms is you know, how can this be better? Sorry to interrupt you, but I actually think, you know, the moment we get into solutions, we've moved really away from this is an actuality and how is this? And how is this? You know, I don't have solutions. You know, I mean, I, if at the moment I'm into solutions, I'm into fixing something, You know, and I would love it to be fixed. I would love it that this is not the situation of anyone's life. But I think we can go there too quickly and actually move away from just that stillness and then asking, what does this need? Or what can be offered? Because I don't want to move into my world of solutions and away from the world of another who's really in distress. Yes, sorry. Yes, I know. Well, it's not impossible. It's not impossible. I know. I know. I know. It gets stuck in your throat, makes you want to choke. And that's a discomfort we're asked to bear. That's a discomfort we're asked to bear. I mean, the other part, take that a little bit further, you know. Would you actually wish to harm somebody? No, really go there. Really go there. Yeah. Yeah. Then it's easier to stay with that stuck in your throat. You know what happens when things stay stuck in your throat for too long? You choke. Sis?
Isn't some part of swallowing the blame recognizing some of our own patterns that are also manifested?
Yes. I think a big part is moving out of the I and the you.
Yeah, and just
we are the children of the conditions in our lives, you know. We are the children of the conditions in our lives. Many of the habit patterns that we find in ourselves, you know, we inherit, you know. We inherit. We are the children of the conditions in our life. I think the path of awakening comes when we know that and actually know that just because something has a long history doesn't mean it has a long future. You know, this is the key, you know. We, no matter how much we have inherited, it's not a life sentence. It can change those patterns. And actually blame is often making that self another, saying, well, you know, I can recognize maybe I'm the child of the conditions of my life, you know, my parents, grandparents, culture, but you're not. This is a thorny subject. It's a thorny one. Because, you know, this, you know, compassion has never been presented as an easy path. This is, of all the Brahmaviharas, I think it's probably the most challenging. You know, and again, you know, it there's places where it's really easy and there's places where it is really, really hard. You know, and, you know, certainly the inspiration for me practicing, as I mentioned the other day, was actually to be living in a refugee community, you know, who'd suffered endlessly and yet somehow were intact, and trying to figure out, how did they do that? Or how do they do that? You know, what do they understand that I don't understand? You know, why are they not bitter and despairing and hating and vengeful, to say, they know something I don't know. And they were not passive. You know, they were not passive. So, are we ready to move on a little bit? We can return, if you like. I want to talk about this third quality of the Brahmaviharas, of mudita. It's often presented in the Brahmavihara teachings as appreciative joy. Please don't use the phrase sympathetic joy. It's appreciative joyfulness. a capacity we have. It is the dearest friend of compassion. And this comes back to your question. You know, I find in teaching people who really work on the front lines of suffering, you know, or people who are living on the front lines of suffering themselves right now in terms of, you know, difficult life situations, really difficult life situations, or illness or dying. You know, in the sort of health services, you know, they talk about compassion fatigue or burnout, the sense you have of being spent after a day of really being at the front lines of dukkha. I'm not convinced there is such a thing as compassion fatigue. I'm very convinced there's a reality that when we are not, when compassion is actually not married to joyfulness, we are at risk of collapse in the face of suffering. It is joyfulness that actually resources the heart, you know. And I think when you're meeting the raw edges of dukkha all the time, you simply cannot afford a joyfulness deficit. You cannot afford a joyfulness deficit, you know. And I think for some people, you know, they actually feel, oh no, that would be so frivolous, you know. Look at the immensity of the dukkha in the world, you know, or look at the harshness and the hardship I'm facing, you know. It would be frivolous to cultivate joyfulness. It's actually not frivolous at all. And it actually teaches actually a lot about coexistence, you know. Because, you know, again, to really be aware inwardly how hardwired we are in our attentional field to focus on the imperfect and what is wrong and what is broken. To actually appreciate what is well takes training. And there is coexistence here. There is coexistence. You know, at the moment you might be sitting with a knee that hurts or a back that's sore. Perhaps a touch of your lips together is actually quite well. Or perhaps the palm of your hand is actually quite well. Because see what happens when we focus only on the difficult, the contractedness that comes, how with the contractedness there comes more identification, how with contractedness there, it's kind of very selective perception. Joyfulness is necessary to the human heart, even in the most dire situations. Without it, I think we often are at risk of collapsing beneath the weight of dukkha. Joyfulness is not frivolous. It's actually the way that we resource ourselves inwardly to meet life as it is. It's so interesting that how mudita or this joyfulness is spoken about often much less than any of the other Brahma Viharas, you know, as if it's some sort of incidental thing, you know. Oh, a little joy would be good, you know, but let's get down to the serious work, you know, of metta and compassion and equanimity. No, joyfulness is, I think it is central. Central. And you cannot make yourself joyful, but you can make room for joy. And that takes intention, it takes a particular kind of attention, it takes stillness, it takes mindfulness, it takes remembering. You know, sometimes you could just step outside the door here, you know, and you might see, you know, the buildings that are a bit broken, you know, what needs painting and the traffic, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then you see the sprig of green growing out of a crack in the sidewalk. You can actually attend to this too. You can attend to this too. It's about making room for joyfulness. It actually guards compassion from selective perception that only perceives what is broken and brings into the field of our attention that which is well, and this actually resources us inwardly. You know, I think culturally, individually, we can really be living with a joy deficit. You know, and you know what that does to us. you know. It is joyfulness that brings kindness and serenity to equanimity, and it teaches us to appreciate and to celebrate what is well, what the goodness in others, what is well in the moment, the goodness in ourselves, to actually begin to celebrate this. There's different ways that joyfulness is spoken about in the tradition. Sometimes we hear the word mudita, sometimes we hear the word piti, and the Buddha speaks about sensual joyfulness and non-sensual joyfulness. He speaks about worldly joyfulness and non-worldly joyfulness, all very, very sort of strange or awkward concepts. It's interesting that the quality of empathy that is so central to the development of compassion is the same quality of empathy that is central to the cultivation of joyfulness. In compassion, it's the empathy that can tremble in the face of the difficult and the painful. In the cultivation of joyfulness, it's the same empathy of the heart that can tremble in the face of the lovely. Touching and being touched by the world. It takes some sensitivity, as I mentioned. It takes intention. It takes a particular attention. It takes mindfulness. It takes stillfulness. But it is possible for us. Mudita has its roots in the Pali word to gladden. And the Buddha speaks about liberating the heart through gladness. So what he's speaking about here are not sort of, you know, high states of euphoria or excitement or exhilaration or rapture, although they may have touches of joy in them. But we're actually talking about an inwardly generated joyfulness. An inwardly generated joyfulness, although that taste of inwardly generated joyfulness may actually begin with joyfulness that is generated outwardly. This sensual joyfulness, this worldly joyfulness, this capacity to appreciate what is lovely. And there is much, you know, as much as Buddhism has a reputation for being life-denying, it's actually about being life appreciating. You know, there is much in the world of, you know, in the world of art, in the world of painting, in the world of music, in the world of dance, in the world of nature, that is essentially lovely. And sometimes our capacity to bring empathy to that, to be touched by that, to appreciate that, gives us a taste and perhaps some confidence in our own capacity for joyfulness. Because as we all know, you know, you could be in the most delightful, idyllic situation, and, you know, if you're not there, you know, you can be entirely miserable. Yeah? So we're teaching ourselves, we're training ourselves in the art of learning to appreciate, the learning to taste the lovely. Not craving. So it's not about craving, it's not about chasing the pleasant, but appreciating the lovely that is present. This is important skill. This is really beginning to develop a heart that can be gladdened. Developing a mind that can be gladdened. And, you know, it's not hard to develop a mind that can't be gladdened. You know, do a lot of obsession, do a lot of rumination, you know, do a lot of blame, do a lot of aversion, you know. You're actually on a path of developing a heart that can't be gladdened. We're engaged in the skill of developing a mind, a heart that can be gladdened. In the Dhammapada, the Buddha speaks about mudita, saying, live in joy. Live with metta, even among those who hate. Live in joy. Live with wellness, even among the afflicted. Live in joy. Live in peace, even amongst the troubled. Look within. Be still. Free from fear and clinging. Know the sweet joy of the way. Know the sweet joy of the way. This is our invitation. This is our invitation. Okay. We've been here for an hour. You're probably ready to move. At least, I'm sure, you're ready to move. I'd suggest we take half an hour walking practice, time for your body to stretch out a bit. And then if we come back at 11:30, we'll have some time for a little bit more on joyfulness and time for maybe any questions and a sitting before lunch.